Welcome to Talking History and this special Veterans Day show. This is Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Every Veterans Day, we honor those who have served their country by serving in the nation's armed force. In the past, and even for many today, when we think of our nation's veterans, we think only of men. But women served in the country's armed forces, too. And that is the subject of our interview this week on Talking History when Creighton historian Dennis Mihalik talks to author Doris Weatherford. But before we get to that, let's take a look at a key event from this week in history. During this week in 1927, Joseph Stalin became ruler of the Soviet Union. Born in 1879, Stalin's mother hoped he would become a priest. Instead, while enrolled in a seminary in Georgia, Stalin converted to Marxism and atheism. Over the next 15 years, he spread his revolutionary socialist ideas through every occupation he held. In 1914, after spending 7 years in jail for agitation, Tsar Nicholas II exiled Stalin to Siberia, but upon the Tsar's execution in 1918, Vladimir Lenin summoned Stalin and gave him a position in the new communist regime. When Lenin died in 1924, Stalin challenged Leon Trotsky for control of the Soviet Union, a struggle Stalin won when Trotsky was expelled from the Communist Party and the country. By the time Stalin died in 1953, he built the Soviet Union into an industrial and military superpower, but he did so through the use of political terrorism, the likes of which have seldom been seen in history. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, recent hurricane floodwaters have damaged more than North Carolina's agricultural and industrial production. They've also eroded the state's many historical sites. Towns like Windsor, Trenton, and Tarboro date back to the colonial period and are the location of many historic homes and battlefields. The flooding, however, which produced some of the highest state water levels in 500 years, buckled the floors of many of those homes and washed away other historic artifacts. Officials speculate that some of the flooded sites may be lost forever. Ironically, these rivers were once the lifeblood of those historic towns. They provided the residents with transportation and communication routes to the outside world, without which they would not have survived. Now those same life-giving rivers threaten to obliterate any sign of that history. Some 500 Christians from the United States and Europe recently made a pilgrimage to Jerusalem to seek forgiveness for the Christian Crusades, which 900 years ago led to the slaughter of thousands of Jewish and Muslim people. The largely Christian evangelical group retraced the steps of the Crusaders' army that descended on Jerusalem in 1099 in an attempt to conquer the Holy Land and put the Church of the Holy Sepulchre back under Christian dominion. It is directly from the words of Jesus Christ that we must seek forgiveness, and that is what we are doing, explained Matthew Hand, organizer of the pilgrimage. When you ask a Muslim or a Jew from the Middle East about Christianity, he continued, a touchstone for them is often the Crusades. That is the lens through which they view Christian history. You're listening to Talking History. On Veterans Day, we pause to remember those who have served in the nation's armed forces, defending the nation, often at the expense of their own lives. Women played an increasingly significant role in the American armed forces, and they are the subject of today's interview in which Talking History's Dennis Mihalik talks to Doris Weatherford.
November 11th is Veterans Day. Here to give us a perspective on women in war and female veterans is Doris Weatherford, a political consultant and freelance writer, who is the author of American Women and World War II, published by Facts on File. Welcome, Ms. Weatherford.
Hi, how are you?
Let me begin with the simplest question. When did women first enter military service in the United States?
Well, actually, that's not a simple question at all. I'm sorry. It really is quite technical. In the first woman to earn a soldier's pension was Margaret Corbin in the Revolutionary War. There have been women in every war that America has ever fought, although usually not formally or intentionally. But in the Revolution, there were women who participated. Molly Pitcher is not a legendary figure. She was a real woman. Her name was Mary Hayes. There were other women who received soldiers' pensions and who were recognized as members of the military. The same was true in the Civil War. On both sides, there were women who were given rank, who were acknowledged as members of the military. A book by a man named Frank Moore that was published in 1866, just a year after the war was over, said that he thought as many as 400 graves of unidentified people might have been women who had disguised themselves as men and fought. I think that's probably high. But the point is that there have always been women who have participated in the military itself, in addition to huge numbers of women who played supportive roles. Formally, there were women who were contract employees of the Army during the Spanish-American War. And from that, the military realized that they needed a nurse corps. So the nurse corps, Army Nurse Corps, was created in 1901. The Navy Nurse Corps in 1908. And then in the last days of World War I, the Navy researched its enlistment law and found that it didn't say anything about gender. And they enlisted about 13,000 women in the Navy and a lesser number, about 300, in the Marines in the last days of World War I. And then the WAC, the Army, the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps initially, and then later the Women's Army Corps itself, was created in 1942. By the middle of 1943, every branch of the military had a unit for women.
Mm-hmm. Now, what kinds of roles did women perform in the various branches of the armed services?
Almost everything. And really earlier than people think. Of the Army's 625 military occupational specialties, MOSs, women were doing 401 already by the early days of World War II. Women did everything from air traffic control to map drawing to computing to working as mechanics. They trained dogs. They trained carrier pigeons. They worked as instructors, especially teaching men all kinds of things that needed to be learned.
Now, did
there were
men
hundreds who were photographers, just mm-hmm. lots and lots of jobs.
Now, I mean, did men easily accept these women as their teachers?
Actually, surprisingly, yes. The first thing you have to understand is that the average woman who enlisted was older than the average man, especially the average man who was drafted. These women went of their own free will. They were not drafted like men were. And so automatically you get people who are more patriotic, who have higher qualifications. And men are accustomed to being taught by women in school, in high school. And the instructors did not face a lot of problem with that. Often men didn't realize, or at least sometimes they didn't realize, they were being taught by women. There were women in the WASP, the Women's Air Service Pilots, for example, who were themselves well-qualified pilots and who did things like train men to shoot at planes by flying the plane, and the men were supposed to hit the banner that was trailing along behind the plane, and often the men on the ground didn't know that that plane was being towed by a woman.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In World War II, where did women serve? That is, I mean, you know, which theaters of war?
Again, it's a little bit complex. The Nurse Corps was everywhere. The Army Nurse Corps served everywhere, from Alaska to Australia and points in between, even remote places like Iran and India. There were members of the Nurse Corps who were on Bataan and Corregidor when the Japanese first started bombing there and who were prisoners of war for the duration. When Congress passed the act that created the WACs, the Army Nurse Corps, or excuse me, the Women's Army Corps, they allowed women to go everywhere, and WACs did. The WACs opened up for recruitment in May of 42, and by the end of that year, the first WACs were on their way to North Africa. The Congress, however, did not, they wrote in a restriction on the Navy when they created the WAVES, and the WAVES were not allowed to go overseas, although many women joined the WAVES hoping that they would and being told by recruiters that this was a distinct possibility, but it actually was not until late in the war that the WAVES finally got to go, which was a tremendous underutilization because WAVES had to be college graduates to join, and a lot of them could have done more overseas than they were allowed to do.
Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, did the United States use women in combat zones or in combat?
Not deliberately, not intentionally, no. But by accident, it happens a lot. Again, especially with the nurse corps, nurses were bombed many times. Navy nurses on ships, Army nurses on land.
Mm-hmm. Who joined the various services and why?
Most of the women who joined did so for genuinely patriotic reasons. Some saw it as a career opportunity because you've got to remember we're coming out of a depression where women had not been able to get jobs, anything like their abilities. And so the women who joined, particularly the naval branches with their requirements for college education, were looking for career opportunities for advancement. But the overwhelming reason is patriotism. They wanted to win the war. Most of them had a very personal reason. They had a husband, a son, a brother, a boyfriend, somebody that they wanted this war to be over and bring that person home.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned the depression. I mean, did mostly women from poor classes join?
Not so much, again, because of the educational requirements. You had to be a high school graduate to join the Army, and in the Navy, you had to be either a college graduate or have had some college plus some professional experience. So that eliminated large numbers of people because in the 40s, many, many people were not college or were not high school graduates, and it meant that it was almost automatically a little bit elitist.
Mm-hmm. Did white and black join in proportional numbers?
Lots of controversy over that, lots of discussion. Ovita Kaphabi, who was the woman who commanded the Army, was accused of racism almost at the beginning, almost the day she took office, simply because she was from Texas. So she went out of her way to recruit black women. The effect, however, was to end up hurting her own corps because people came to see the WAC as less desirable because there were black women in it. We were still a very openly racist society. The WAVES then decided not to be so welcoming to blacks, did not accept them for a long, long time, not until deep into the war. And so, again, the answer to the question is a little bit complex. They tried to join. They were willing to serve, but the educational requirements and the elitist attitude kept them out.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of black women that got in the service, and it was an era of segregation, what kind of roles were they allowed to perform?
Not as much as they were qualified to do. They were most likely to be sent off to the cooking and laundry kinds of duties, but there were some who achieved. In fact, it was a black WAC unit in France that held the record for speed in sorting mail.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so they acted in the postal service for...
Right.
Okay. Now, as you mentioned, women weren't drafted but recruited. Were enough women recruited to fulfill as many posts as the various branches wanted?
Again, it varied by time. When the Army first opened up applications for women, there were over 13,000 who applied on the first day for 450 available slots. So there was clearly a deep reservoir there of women who wanted to serve. As the war went on, no, they were not able to meet their enlistment quotas for the same reasons that the mail services weren't able to do that. Actually, we should probably go back and say something here about the Army Nurse Corps that most folks are unaware of. We did almost draft nurses. President Roosevelt, in his State of the Union speech in January of 1945, proposed drafting nurses, and the House passed the bill. It had been favorably reported out by the Senate when the Army got to Berlin, and there was no longer any need, and the bill was dropped. But had the war gone on even a month longer in Europe, that bill would have passed, and we would have had the precedent for drafting nurses.
Mm-hmm. And that's obviously because there was a shortage?
Right, right. Mm-hmm. A tremendous shortage. Mm-hmm. And there they did put some wax into the medical corps. But, you know, the military has these traditions and turf wars, and the wax who were put into the medical corps generally were not well received either by the nurse corps or by the male end of the medical corps. And many highly qualified women who had degrees in biology and so forth ended up as mock commandos, and there was a lot of discontent in that area.
Mm. Now, in terms of the World War II vet, we know of all these basic programs that were passed and the help from all of the various veterans organizations. Now, women as veterans, did they receive the same kinds of benefits and help?
On paper, yes, for most of them. In reality, no. They were just not encouraged to think of themselves as veterans. The veterans of foreign wars kept them out of that organization. Even as late as the 70s, President Carter made a speech to a VFW convention and urged them to admit women, and was shouted down. If they did join veterans organizations at all, they were relegated to the female auxiliaries and were there with the wives, and that, of course, is not the experience that they had. So they generally did not take out the housing loans or the employment loans that they could have. Some of them did use it to go back to college, but disappointingly few, especially given that the commander, the woman who commanded the naval, the waves, was herself a college president, President Wellesley College in Massachusetts. There was a disappointing failure to connect the colleges with these women.
Mm-hmm.
It was almost intentional, in my view, almost as though they didn't want these worldly, experienced, sophisticated women on their campuses.
Ah. And does that match the attitudes of the times? I mean, it was 1946, 1947, was that to be expected?
Yes, and another thing we have to factor in there is that colleges were so crowded with men using the GI Bill that some colleges just flat out banned women, didn't admit any women at all in 46 and 47. Other colleges that had been state-supported colleges for women, for example, what currently is Florida State University, used to be Florida College for Women. And when all these men came back from the war and wanted to use the GI Bill, it became a coeducational school, and the women were shoved off to the side.
Mm. Doesn't seem fair, but that's the way history is sometimes.
Yes.
Well, that's all the time we have. I want to thank our guest, Doris Weatherford, author of American Women and World War II, for an insightful discussion.
The Vietnam War was one of the most divisive wars in American history, and perhaps no one suffered more from that divisiveness, experienced even outright hostility for their involvement, than the Vietnam War veterans. Many of those veterans, it is often said, have resorted to or been driven to suicide. But how much truth is there to this common understanding? Here to address that subject in this week's op-ed is Michael Kelly, Vietnam War vet and artist. He has been active in various veterans groups and has used his art to express his feelings on that war and its aftermath in a number of art exhibits and in the design of public monuments. Michael Kelly has titled his op-ed, Unraveling the Myth of Vietnam Veteran Suicide.
In 1996, a veteran organization's newsletter asserted that 160,000 Vietnam veterans had committed suicide since coming home from the war. While claims had been widely circulating since 1980 that more of us had taken our own lives than we'd lost to the enemy, this new extrapolation was staggering in its implications. If true, it meant our suicides were almost three times greater than our battle dead and roughly the equivalent of 10 full Army divisions. Baffled, I sat down with a calculator. 160,000 suicides would require an average daily suicide rate of about 15 suicides every single day for 30 solid years. Was that possible? Mystified by the absence of any corroborating evidence in my own considerable veteran community experience, I was soon entrenched at a library searching for the truth. What I found there left me reeling. Surprisingly, there existed a substantial body of scientific literature on the subject. Perhaps a dozen well-documented mortality studies were prominently listed. During the process of collecting those and other studies over the next year, I was shocked to find that none of the data in any of them suggested a suicide total even remotely approaching the totals of folklore. None of it. Elated by the discoveries, I began approaching those veteran and media organizations routinely trumpeting the suicide totals of myth. Instead of enthusiasm, skepticism, outright disbelief, scorn, and anger were my greeting. Some were astounded anyone would suggest our suicide rate was anything but astronomical. Others accused me of being part of a government conspiracy and dismissed the data as corrupt. It soon became evident that many veterans believed the myth was gospel, and still others wanted to believe it. Sadly, few expressed any sign of hopefulness my conclusions might be accurate. How many Vietnam veterans have committed suicide? Well, actual mortality data tells us that by 1997, our total post-war mortality fell somewhere between 151,000 to 305,000 deaths from all causes. The data also tells us that in 1997, our suicide total likely fell in a range of from 2,000 to 20,000 at the extremes. In my judgment, the most convincing data suggests a range of between 2,000 to 5,000, but in no case would the total exceed 1.23% of our total post-war mortality, 1.11% being normal. Now, anyone who actually believes that more than 15 Vietnam vets have committed suicide every single day over the last 35 years is certainly welcome to that opinion, but it would be exceedingly irresponsible for them to publish such figures without providing some factual data to support the assertion. In the final analysis, the scientific record shows that Vietnam veterans appear to die for the same reasons and at roughly the same rates that everyone else does, mythology notwithstanding. To paraphrase Mark Twain, the principal difference between a cat and a myth is that a cat only has 9 lives. What we have here is a well-entrenched myth in its 9th incarnation.
You've been listening to Michael Kelly, Vietnam War vet and artist. This is Talking History. Welcome back to our special Veterans Day show. For our site of the week, we've chosen a war memorial that stands as a symbol of the nation's gratefulness for the dedicated service of the United States Marines. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
The United States Marine Corps Memorial depicts probably the most famous scene from World War II, the raising of the flag on Iwo Jima in February of 1945. While it stands as a symbol for the honored dead of the U.S. Marine Corps, the 32-foot-high statue is a memorial to all Marines who have given their lives in the defense of the United States since 1775. Located in Washington, D.C., the memorial was dedicated by President Dwight D. Eisenhower in 1954, and under a presidential proclamation of 1961, a cloth flag is flown from the 60-foot flagpole 24 hours a day. The memorial depicts the famous Pulitzer Prize-winning photograph shot by news photographer Joe Rosenthal and later constructed by sculptor Felix de Weldon.
And finally, turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, a museum exhibit, Pharaohs of the Sun, opens this week at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. It focuses on the ancient Egyptian pharaohs Akhenaten, Nefertiti, and Tutankhamun, who ruled Egypt from 1353 to 1336 B.C., during which time Egypt temporarily abandoned its age-old pantheon of gods in favor of one god. It was a period of unprecedented change reflected in the approximately 300 artifacts on display in the exhibit, which closes on February 6th in the year 2000. Two very interesting programs will air on PBS later this month, one on a famous painter and another on an influential prophet. The painter is Norman Rockwell, the subject of an American Masters special on November 24th. This 90-minute documentary follows Rockwell's career from his art student days in New York City to his most successful years as illustrator of American life during the 1960s. On November 26th, watch for American Prophet, the story of Joseph Smith. This two-hour PBS program examines the life of an obscure and ill-educated farm boy who became the leader of one of the world's largest churches, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or the Mormons. Be sure to check your local listings for exact times and with the Boston Museum of Fine Arts for further details on the exhibit, Pharaohs of the Sun. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you will join us next week when we will mark the 10th anniversary of the murder of six Jesuits in El Salvador in the midst of that country's civil war. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.